Do you remember where you were last Saturday night when you first learned that Iran had fired off more than 330 drones and cruise missiles onto Israel? Do you remember that sick feeling, that pit in your stomach, when you turned on to CNN or Fox or whatever, wherever you get your news, and you saw fiery agents of death, 330 of them, being fired onto our brothers and sisters in Israel? So Shira and I spoke with a number of Israelis that night and since, obviously, through the week. And we hear from Israelis three different words to take in the experience of last Saturday night. The first word is apocalyptic, that there was something apocalyptic about the whole experience. We have a good friend who is an Israeli woman living in Boston, and she shared that she has an Israeli sister living in Tel Aviv. And when the Boston sister first learned that the missiles and drones were in the air, she called her sister in Tel Aviv. And over the phone, she could hear the sounds of the sirens blaring. And the Tel Aviv sister said to the Boston sister, "We have to go to the safe room now," going with her husband and three kids to the safe room now. "And we don't know what will be on the other side. We don't know what will be for Israel. We don't know what will be for Tel Aviv. We don't know whether we will be on the other side. Just know that I love you very much." And the Israeli woman living in Boston said, hearing that news against the din of the sirens was apocalyptic. And of course, thank God, no one died. Thank God this family survived. But they didn't know it at the time. And the Boston sister being told, "Know that I love you," from an Israeli sister going into a bomb shelter, didn't know it at the time, all of which makes that apocalyptic. Here's the second word that I heard Israelis say about Saturday night, that it was surreal. We're on the phone all night with our brother and sister-in-law who live in Jerusalem. And they said it was surreal in the following way, that when the siren sounded in Jerusalem, they, of course, went down to their safe room, but they were utterly unable to sleep. And when the sirens stopped sounding, they got out of their safe room, and they could not sleep. Now, what do you do when it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you know that there's drones and missiles in the hundreds being fired on your country and you can't sleep, but you don't have to be in the safe room? So what do? They cleaned their kitchen. And they'd been cleaning their kitchen all week. They said their kitchen has never been so clean. There is something surreal about cleaning your kitchen for the umpteenth time while bombs are being fired at your country. And then the third set of words to describe, after apocalyptic, after surreal, the third comes from Micha Goodman. He calls it radical uncertainty. Micha says there is radical uncertainty about the meaning of the narrative of Saturday night, multiple conflicting narratives that each have something to commend it, and radical uncertainty about what Israel should do next, the aftermath. So how do you understand Saturday night? So one understanding is, it's a miracle. It's a miracle of biblical proportions. Nes gadol hayasham. 330 drones and cruise missiles were fired on Israel. Virtually all of them were swatted down from the sky. Nobody died. Israel's defense and its partnership with its allies, with America and with England and with other unnamed regional powers, worked. Miracle. That's one narrative. The other narrative, miracle, Israel was brazenly attacked by Iran, that sent 330 agents of death into Israel. Yes, we were able to defend. And yes, thank God no Israelis died this time, but who knows for next time? And that's not why Israel exists, to swat down 330 drones and missiles. This is completely unacceptable. It's the opposite of a miracle. It's a horror show. It's a horror show that ended okay for now, but message unfinished. And of course, that leads to radical uncertainty about what to do next. You all know this. Israel must retaliate. Israel should not retaliate. It should declare victory and go home. And of course, what it actually did Thursday night, Friday morning, what a hot mess. And our seders are Monday night. Now, Daniel Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi did a podcast last week, and in it, Daniel asked the question, why is this Pesach different from any other and every other Pesach in our lifetime? And what he had to say was just so simple and clear and true. He said, what makes this Pesach different from any other Pesach is that for the Jewish people and for the Jewish homeland, things are unredeemed. Unredeemed. The Pesach Haggadah tells a story of a happy ark. A happy ark. We go from slavery to freedom. We go from darkness to light. We go from suffering to redemption. Let's sing Hallel. Let's drink wine. Yay. But this year, we read about the happy ark, but we don't experience the happy ark. We haven't gone from darkness to light. We're still in darkness. We are in darkness. And we haven't gone from suffering to redemption. We're still in suffering. Think about 330 drones and missiles. Think about Columbia University. Think about solidarity rallies in Greater Boston yesterday on April 19th. Where college kids in Greater Boston, a few miles from here, are carrying signs that say Zionism is terrorism. Not Hamas is terrorism, but Zionism is terrorism. That's still darkness. That's not light yet. And that's still suffering. That's not redemption yet. So our seders are Monday night. What is our response to the first unredeemed season in most of our lives? Like if you were living during the Holocaust, that's obviously unredeemed. But if, like me, I was born in 61, I've never before had an existence where my own Jewish life and the life of Eretz Yisrael was unredeemed. And this is the first time that it's unredeemed. What is the response? So there is a midrash that's all about charoset that I want to invite you to think about. The traditional reading of charoset is that it's a symbol of bondage. It's mortar. It's the mortar that was used to bind the bricks, that was used to make the pyramids. It's bondage. It's slavery. It's sad. That's the usual reading of charoset. But you may know that in Ashkenazi circles, it's a tradition to make charoset with apples. And where did that come from? Why apples and charoset? So there's a midrash that has a completely different take on charoset, namely as follows, that it was a very hard scrabble life for our Hebrew ancestor slaves. So much so that the males, the Israelite males, decided they were just, They were defeated. They were resigned. They said, we're slaves. Our fathers were slaves. We're the sons of slaves. We don't want to become the parents of slaves. Why bring another generation into existence if they're just going to be slaves? So according to this Midrash, the Israelite men decided no relations with their wives because they didn't believe in a Jewish future. And in response, the Israelite women did not want to give up on hope and did not want to give up on their family and did not want to give up on the Jewish people. And so they seduced their husbands under the shade of apple trees. It's well known that Honeycrisp apples dot the Nile. And so they would give their husbands, instead of all that dry matzah, a Honeycrisp apple. And that put them in a different space. And then they seduced them. And then another generation came to be. And according to this Midrash, Charoset is not a symbol of bondage. It's a symbol of resistance to bondage. It's not a symbol of bondage. It's a symbol of resilience in the face of bondage, of saying we are not giving up on hope. Now, here's the thing about this Midrash. It's just so rich. Because the Israelite men, they were not wrong. They were, in some sense, right. It was horrific to be a slave, and their parents were slaves, and they were slaves. And they were right that if they were going to bring another child into the world, their next generation would be slaves too. Enough with slavery. The decision of the Israelite males was entirely rational. I just want to summon their voice because their voice is out there now as we talk about Israel today. I was talking to Micha Goodman, our beloved friend and teacher, the day after the bombs, and he said, Israel right now has three really bad cards in its hand. Israel has three bad cards in its hand, according to Micha. First bad card is many, many Israelis lack confidence and trust in their leadership, in their government. And that feels hard to dispute. The rallies of tens of thousands, of more than 100,000 in Tel Aviv. So you have the crisis of a war, and you have the crisis of a leadership crisis in the middle of a war. That's a bad card. The second bad card is that Israel's good name has taken a bad hit as a result of this war in Gaza. That cannot be denied. And the third bad card that Israel has in its hand, crisis of leadership, tarnished name, is its enemies are emboldened. The Persian Empire is emboldened. Hamas is not crushed. Iran is there doing what it did Saturday night brazenly. Hezbollah, Houthis, it's just a hot mess. So what are we supposed to do? So this Midrash tells us, it's a Midrashic form, really, of Max's beautiful Devar Torah. We have a choice. We could be like the Israelite men and give up, but that's not why we have apples in our charoset. We have apples in our charoset so that we are inspired to channel the resilience of the Israelite women, who said, Lamrot HaKol, despite it all, we're never giving up. So I want to tell you a story about an Israeli apple. I want to tell you a story about an American apple. And I want to leave you with the question for your seders. Here's the Israeli apple. You know, Micha founded this program which inspires 20 and 30-something Israelis after their military service to rediscover the power of their own Judaism. and to rediscover the power of their own Zionism. And the name of this program is Mabua, which means in Hebrew, spring water. It's a deeply sourced flowing of water and positive energy. And Mabua has this program called the Elul program, which is 40 days of learning and Jewish living. The climax is on Yom Kippur. It's the Elul program, 40 days ending with the Jewish holidays, ending with Yom Kippur. And this year, they've done it for years, but for the first time ever, one of the sites is going to be in the Gaza envelope. Never done Gaza before. They're doing Gaza envelope this year for the first time, and why? So I'll never forget when October 7th happened, and came, it was Simchas Torah, it was Shabbos, came to Shul, we just couldn't even wrap our head around it. Amy Klein and I, right after services were over, called Micha from my study and said, "Oh my God, Micha." And he said something that I've never forgotten. He said it on October 7th. He said that Israel cannot be unless Israelis live in the Gaza envelope. If Israelis won't live in the Gaza envelope, if Americans won't come visit the Gaza envelope, if nobody will go to Sderot, if nobody will go to the kibbutzim in the Gaza envelope, Israel won't be. Israel cannot, you can't put all of Israel in the Imbal Hotel in Jerusalem. We have to go back to the Gaza envelope. And Micha is not just saying that other people should do it. He's doing it for 40 days. His students are doing it for 40 days. His teachers and faculty are doing it for 40 days. That is an Israeli apple. The American apple, so those of you who were here at the early part of the service heard Mike Eisman, who was in Israel last Saturday night. And Mike was kind enough to share an email and kind enough to allow me to share just a part of it. He writes in this email, when he's talking about sleeping on his bed in his shoes, "I heard a few faraway explosions and many airplanes flying overhead, but no sirens. I stayed away from the TV and social media because the videos of the rockets was just too much for me. Around 4 a.m., I got word that the assault was over, and I was able to fall back to sleep for a few more hours. I woke up at 7, and the sun was shining. The full Israeli breakfast was ready in the lobby. I packed my suitcase, walked along the beach to my new hotel. There were people out running, surfing, getting coffee. If I didn't have a smartphone, I would have woken up thinking nothing out of the ordinary had happened. That's how it's been since Sunday morning. Life feels back to normal." Then he writes, "I have seen and heard from so many Israelis how alone they feel in the world and how much they appreciate us being here with them." So what does an American apple look like? We live here. We don't live there. How do you assess our apple living here when they're the ones having the sleepless nights over there? So I want to come back to this powerful midrash. What did the Israelite women accomplish and not accomplish under the shade of those honey-crisp apple trees that dot the Nile? Here's what they didn't do. They didn't actually change the facts on the ground. They didn't actually get rid of slavery. They didn't actually stop the taskmaster's whip. They didn't actually free the Israelites. But here's what those Israeli women under the shade of the apple tree did do. They could control their attitude, and they could control their next step, and they could say and role model their husbands, "We are not giving up on life and not giving up on our family and not giving up on their Jewish future." And that's what they did when they ate that apple, and that's what they did when they seduced their husbands, and that's what they did when they brought children into the world, even now. And that's what Mike Eisman and the JNF volunteers did. And that's what, by the way, eighth graders from Solomon Schechter Day School of Greater Boston and their parents who let them fly to Jerusalem and Israel just now, and their teachers and faculty, that's what they did. They didn't change the underlying facts. They didn't stop the hatred flowing out of the Persian Empire. And they didn't stop bombs from being fired into Israel. But they did let Israelis know that they are not alone. They did let Israelis know, "We are here with you." They did let Israelis know the power of our love. And that brings us back to the Seders on Monday night. For all the other years of our lives, we lived in redeemed Jewish time, which meant there were only four questions. But now, we live in unredeemed Jewish time, unredeemed for the Jewish people, unredeemed for the state of Israel. So now we need a fifth question. Here's the fifth question. What am I going to do for Israel? What am I going to do for the Jewish people? What will my apple be? Shabbat Shalom.